this is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Dogs are great, but in Vermont, they're pretty much everywhere. Saturday, I went into Burlington for the farmer's market. From the downtown parking garage to the market, I counted 8 dogs walking on Church Street. Once I got to the market, I would have needed an abacus and an auditor to keep track. It was Dog City. Later that day, I attended a picnic with about 60 people. There was one very cute bulldog puppy who actually seemed to like me. Today, we want to look at where and when dogs should be in attendance and how their owners should look after them. But we also want to make sure non-dog owners understand their role in this human-canine dance, when to approach or not, when it's appropriate to give a dog a snack. And in the interest of full disclosure, I must tell you that I have no living things in my care. Joining us to discuss this topic are Dr. Susan McMillan, a veterinarian and owner of the Old North End Veterinary Clinic and the Vet2Pet Mobile Veterinary Service in Burlington, and Whitney DeRemus, a certified dog trainer and owner of Superdogs Positive Pet Dog Training. I want to thank you both for being here.
Good afternoon.
Hi there. Thanks.
All right. Susan, first of all, should dog ownership come with a manual?
Oh, God. I wish it could. Yes. But the first line of the manual would be considerate and take responsibility for your pet.
Yeah. What are the basic elements of ownership that people should realize before they adopt a dog?
I think that dogs don't train themselves. You don't end up with a well-behaved companion usually just by luck. It takes effort. Some people say that their dogs are like their kids, and in that sense, you do need to raise them upright. You need to put in the time, put in the training. They don't just become good little citizens and good companions by chance.
Mm-hmm. Well, Whitney, isn't caring for a dog pretty close to caring for a child?
That's an interesting question. There's a word that's used a lot in the dog training world called anthropomorphism. And what that means is putting human characteristics upon, in this case, it's a canine. So I would be careful about answering that as far as it's no, you're not raising a child, you're raising a dog. And it's worth considering that a dog is wonderful in every way that a dog is, but it's a dog.
And what are kind of the keys to training it properly?
A huge question there.
Yeah, yes. Give us a small answer, though.
Here's some really important things to keep in mind. Dogs live in the present all the time, so timing is absolutely key. Dogs don't understand things like being punished for something that happened while you were at work. That's a good example. So that's important. Dogs are contextual thinkers, so they learn well in a certain context. They don't generalize well. That's important. And it's important to understand that dogs are led by their nose, not by eyesight like us. So these are just a few examples as far as learning about how dogs learn, I think is an important piece of dog ownership.
All right. Now let's go to some questions of etiquette. And listeners, feel free to jump in with your own questions or with your thoughts on what should be expected of dog owners. You can call 1-800-639-2211. You can call that number, 1-800-639-2211, or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. And before we get to those questions, I want to read a couple listener points we heard from Cynthia. She tweeted, I love being able to take my dog camping at Vermont State Parks. He loves people and riding in the kayak. And from the good owner, bad dog category is Scott, who posted on Facebook, and he says, I like dogs. They must be friendly and well-behaved out in public. Mine aren't, so they stay home.
Good for you.
Right?
Yes, that is the answer.
So how do you kind of know that my dog is not the dog to take out in public? Susan?
I think if you hear yourself making excuses for your dog all the time, think about leaving him at home. If you're always saying, oh, he just needs to... You know, he's just really friendly. He's just really excited. He just wants to meet you. If you're making excuses because he's probably jumping on people or he's lunging on the end of his leash or maybe he's growling. You know, he's just a little scared. He's just timid. Those are the animals that need to back up a little bit and maybe not always stay home, but maybe not be in the circumstances that you've put them in.
Where should we feel okay about taking our dogs? What are the places they should go, Whitney?
I feel that dogs are very appropriate, in all of our parks in Vermont, hopefully on pathways and hiking and, of course, on your private boat, on the islands that you can get to. But to echo what Susan says, I feel that the dog should be a joy for you and for the people around you.
Now, growing up, I never saw a dog in a restaurant. Now in Vermont, if there's a patio, I see a dog in a restaurant. Susan, appropriate? Not?
Again, it depends on the dog. And I think it probably depends on the restaurant. There are a couple of websites that you can check to see if a business, a restaurant in particular, is dog-friendly. There's a website called bringfido.com, dogfriendly.com. There's one called Dogster. And you can evaluate or ask the business. I think Outdoor Gear Exchange, fine, bring your pet if he's well-behaved. And other places, they don't want your animal there, no matter how friendly he is. So it's really important to those of us who like having our dogs with us to remember that not everyone wants your dog. And we have to respect their wishes, too, I think. Some dogs do great on Church Street. Other dogs, it's just not a good fit. Or maybe it's fine at 6 in the morning, but not on a busy Saturday afternoon. Maybe it's too chaotic for your pet, too scary. If your dog is uncomfortable somewhere, don't take him.
Well, where are the places we should definitely not take our dog, Whitney?
The hospital comes to mind. Definitely not. I think a lot of indoor restaurants, just about anything indoors. We need to be very respectful of retail environments, schools. I think that a good example of maybe not might be a ball field where kids are playing. Mm-hmm. Again, back to the dog. Is the dog appropriate in a situation like that?
And Susan, is there a difference between, say, a puppy? Can I get away with taking a puppy to places that maybe a grown-up dog I can't take?
Yes, but it would go both ways. Sometimes an older dog might be more comfortable going somewhere, and a younger dog might be nervous or maybe not thoroughly vaccinated. It probably also depends a little bit on the size of your dog, whether it's appropriate. Certainly, people with really tiny dogs get away with a lot more. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have run into people and their pets are in a little carrying case that I didn't even realize there was anything living in there. So I guess you can probably get away with things. But if your dog barks a lot or is disruptive, then, I go to a church and there is a woman who brings her dog to church and it seems to be well tolerated because the dog is, you would hardly know he was there, except once he did bark when someone spoke up very loudly and the dog started barking and it was a little chaotic in the middle of church. But for the most part, it works out fine. But I think she probably asked the people that run the church and it was an okay arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Dog owners, are there questions about canine etiquette that you've always wondered about? When it's okay to let your dog off leash? And when they are on leash, is it okay to use that long retractable leash? Non-dog owners, come on. Give us your gripes. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You could also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Newbury. We got a call from Joanne. Joanne, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a service dog, and I would say my gripe is with people, not dogs.
Right.
I cannot tell you the number of times that I have been out with him and people just walk up and they're like, oh, hi, buddy, or they just start petting him. They don't teach their children not to behave, as they are in a park. This is different. I've had to say he's working. So
does he wear a vest?
To learn how to treat service dogs.
Joanne, did you hear that? Mm-hmm. Does he wear a vest?
Oh, yes. He's in full gear.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's take up service dogs. There's therapy dogs, emotional support dogs. Whitney, can you kind of briefly explain the difference between those types of dogs?
Yes, I can. A service dog is one that the ADA recognizes as is there to perform a task for a person with a disability. This dog is taught to recognize and respond to a situation. An emotional support dog is, I think it'd be fair to say that all of our dogs are emotional support dogs, frankly. they're there to make a person feel better, which all of our dogs tend to do. That's why we have them. A therapy dog is most often somebody's pet dog who has gone through a little additional training in order to visit nursing homes, hospitals, and things like this to cheer people up. So those are the distinctions, and it is important to recognize what a service dog is versus an emotional support or therapy dog.
Now, as a non-owner, how are we to act around these types of dogs? Because you see them and you love that they're performing this kind of service, and you really do want to just go hug them, you know, pet them. Susan.
If you see a dog wearing a vest, then you should realize that he's working and that it's not appropriate for you to go up and pet him or hug him or give him treats or anything. You should talk to the person and ask, and they will probably say, well, thank you, no, he's working. And then, you know, you just observe him and enjoy that he's a working dog, and you just don't get to pet that dog.
Yeah.
You should actually treat any dog that way. You should ask before you pet any dog. You know, sometimes people come up and some people are really well trained. They say, is it okay if I pet your dog? Is it okay if my kid pets your dog? Other people just come running up and try to pet your dog, and you can end up in bad situations that way.
And Whitney, not only that question, but also now I have a dog. You know, how do I not have my dog interact improperly with this service dog?
I'd like to say first that it's important to recognize that a service dog is working, as Susan said, and you are only helping with their training by ignoring. One of the primary jobs of a service dog is to learn to ignore distractions, such as humans and other dogs. So if you have another dog, rely on your commands. And if you haven't taught them, teach them so that you can make sure that your other dog doesn't interact with a working dog.
All right, let's go back to the phones and talk to Laura, who's calling from Shaftesbury. Hi, Laura. How are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a non-dog owner and have a cat who goes outside. And every so often, I see a couple of dogs just kind of running around the neighborhood, not on leash, no persons nearby. And the dogs have hassled my cat. And I've got to say, it really bothers me. But I don't really know what to do. I think there's supposed to be a dog, I don't know. I don't know if it's a dog catcher or whatever, you know, with the town. But the position isn't filled. There isn't really anybody to go to. But, you know, it does bother me. And, you know, I don't want to make a ruckus in the neighborhood or with neighbors. I don't even know who the dogs belong to. Mm. But do you have any suggestions for this type of situation when you see just dogs running around loose?
Yeah, dogs off leash. Big question we'll get to a lot today. Susan?
That's a really tough one. Your first thing would be to talk to your neighbors and see if you can figure out who the dogs belong to. We actually have the same problem. Whitney and I live in the same neighborhood. We have the same problem. There is a dog who wanders loose. He does his route, and he is pretty friendly, but he causes trouble. People don't like it. He really shouldn't wander off leash. So what you need to do, if you can, is first find out who owns these dogs. At some point, if you talk to your neighbors enough, you're going to be able to trace back to where these guys live. And then ideally, you just go to them and politely say, you know, it's really not okay that your dogs are running off leash. And no one likes to hear that. And I don't know if it'll get solved or not. You do have a town animal control officer, but it's probably not full time. Like you said, all you can do is continue to report them, I guess, if you've tried to talk to them and it doesn't resolve.
I just had an idea. I thought if you can get your hands on this dog and he's a friendly dog, you could put a note on his collar or something and send him home.
Great idea. Mary's calling in from Montpelier. Mary, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question?
Hi. My question has to do with the fact that I have a small 3-year-old dog, and he's a rescue dog. He's very anxious. I finally gave in and am now giving him some Prozac, but he's still anxious. And what he does is he snarls and snaps. So I'm careful about not letting people pet him. Mm-hmm. But how do you find and vet a good trainer that would be a good match for us?
Whitney, that's a great question for you.
Yeah, that's a really nice question to hear. You know, there are certifications for trainers. There's a variety of them that you can explore. But a dog trainer does not need to be certified to be a dog trainer or even to be a good dog trainer. And a good dog trainer isn't necessarily certified. So that may or may not be helpful for you. Definitely interview and ask the questions of the dog trainer that you would need help with. Get a feel for them. I think that in working with a dog trainer with a case like yours, which is fairly complicated, there's probably a lot going on. You would want to be sure that your personality works well with theirs so that you can work through this situation with your dog and get some good results.
Now, other than walks around the neighborhood, visits to immediate family, I would imagine that the dog park is the first place you'll take Fido or Fifi. When do you know that they're ready for that, first of all, Susan?
Rule of thumb is we say to not probably take them to a full-fledged dog park until they're probably 4 months old. Some dogs go earlier. You want to make sure they're comfortable. You don't want to take a young dog into a situation that is going to make him fearful, especially at that age. I think Whitney would agree. You want encounters to be positive because there's a window there when a dog learns a lot about anxiety, and you don't want to create things that make him anxious. So you don't want to force him to be social. You don't want him to be around bigger dogs or a lot of dogs if he's going to be nervous. You want it to be totally a positive experience. And you want him to be socialized, but before he encounters the whole world of dogs, you probably want him to be vaccinated. So you want to get a couple of vet appointments under your belt. But I encourage people to have their pets meet other animals. Maybe your friends have dogs. Maybe you don't go full on to the dog park, but you go to a fenced yard. So your dog does get socialized with other dogs, but maybe not in the big, you know, bus station that is a dog park. Mm-hmm.
Well, conflicts, though, will happen there. So what is the best way to handle those little tete-a-tetes that occur there, Whitney?
A dog park, it can be such a recipe for disaster, unfortunately. And, you know, I say that having helped many dog parks open. I'm not opposed to them. Here I will draw an analogy to children, as you did earlier. Much like people want their children to meet other quality children, other well-adjusted, nice children. It is wonderful when we can arrange that for our dogs. And we can't always do that at a dog park. At a dog park, you combine dogs who often aren't socialized well with people who don't know how to read dog body language. And that's where these conflicts come from. So to answer your question, I think when you arrive at the dog park, kind of survey who's there, what dogs are there, what are the basic behaviors that are happening. And if it looks like a good day to hang out, hang out. And if a dog shows up that makes you nervous, things like circling and a dog coming in and snapping at your dog, these are bullying behaviors that can lead to prey and pack situations that can be dangerous and scary. And again, you've got a lot of humans at a dog park who don't know what they're looking at. So people don't know when to intervene.
Wow, that's a great tip. In Vermont, we love dogs unless we don't. Today, we're discussing how dog lovers and their pets can get along with other dogs and with those in the population who aren't comfortable with your puppy jumping up on them. Coming up, we're going to talk about hiking with your dogs. To join the conversation, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Rick Zingari, and this is Vermont Edition. It's almost impossible not to melt when you see someone's labradoodle or a husky puppy. But who says you can just go over and pet them? And while you're falling in love, the person next to you might be cowering in fear. What responsibility does the dog's owner have? We're speaking with Whitney DeRemus, a certified dog trainer and owner of Superdog's Positive Pet Dog Training, and Dr. Susan McMillan, veterinarian and owner of the Old North End Veterinary Clinic and the Vet2Pet Mobile Veterinary Service in Burlington. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you on the matter. What side of the dog fence do you fall on? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. All right, so I said we're going to talk a little about hiking. We got a few emails. First of all, Janie says, I was on a hiking trail yesterday, ran into three dogs that were not on leashes. We thought we were going to get bit. Why are people so stupid? And Tara posts, I love to bring my dog out on a hike, to the beach, on road trips, etc. He's a member of the family, but he is always on a leash in public places. I would appreciate if others would keep their dogs on a leash. All right, Susan.
I know.
It's when you're out on a hike, what is correct? This is the time when dogs that need exercise really can run.
I
see you wrestling with this.
I know, because I have a dog, and I like to let her run, and she needs to be under voice command at all times, and I need to know where she is at all times. And if there are any people nearby, I need to make sure she comes back to me and she's on leash. I don't know if those people like dogs or don't like dogs or have a dog or are afraid of dogs. It's my problem to keep my dog in my world and not mess up your hike, because maybe you're very fearful. Maybe you just, you know, maybe you just don't like dogs. Maybe you're allergic. I don't know. I need to assume you don't like my dog until I hear otherwise, I think.
And what do you think is the right thing to do when I'm out on a hike on a mountain somewhere? Why not let it off leash?
Oh, it's tempting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there probably are times when it is appropriate. Again, as Susan says, when there are other people around, other dogs around, and you feel quite confident that you've got good voice control over your dog. However, no matter how confident you are, there's no way you're 100%. With a leash, you are 100%. And the reality is that the more dogs that get out there off leash causing problems, the less places we're going to be able to bring our dogs. And although we're not discussing it, I want to be sure to mention that picking up after your dog is another reason why dogs aren't allowed in public.
All right. So I thought we had an agreement. I mean, I thought, you know, somewhere along the line, we'd all decided that that was the deal, right? If the dog poops, the owner will be there scooping and putting it in a bag and taking care of it.
Seems pretty basic, doesn't it? I've seen it myself. The owner turns away, kind of acts like they didn't see something happen.
Right.
And then they continue walking. And I think as a pet owner, it's my responsibility to say, hey, I guess you didn't see Fido just pooped. Here, I have an extra bag for you. And, you know, I would always rather deal with something calmly rather than turn it into a confrontation. But we just need to remind people, you need to pick up after your dog.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're near the lake, not near the lake. You know, you just need to pick up after your
dog. It's kind of a zero tolerance policy.
It should be zero tolerance.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. For the non-dog owner like me, I think I've learned everything I know about approaching someone's animal from the movie The Truth About Cats and Dogs. And so far, it seems to have worked. But what is the right protocol and proper technique when I see a black lab I just have to pet? And how do I know if that dog, you know, is approachable, wants me to come over and play with it? Whitney, please.
Well, the first thing you do is ask permission from the owner. Always appreciated. And by the way, dog owners, if you get asked permission, you might as well reinforce that human behavior by saying thank you for asking permission. So start there. And if you get permission, always worthwhile to keep an eye on the dog. Approach slowly. Some tricks are avert your body. Don't stare at the dog. Hold your hand out. Most people know that. Allow your dog to sniff the hand. But watch for things like a dog pulling back from you or trying to get away from you. That dog simply isn't comfortable. And guys, don't take it personally. Some dogs just aren't as socialized as others. And that's all it is. It's not about you.
And if an owner says, oh, he's really shy, or, you know, we're just working on something, please respect them and don't say, oh, I'm a dog whisperer, dogs love me, or don't try to overrule the owner. And owners, if your dog isn't comfortable, just say it. Don't let the encounter happen and then say, oh, yeah, he doesn't really like men with hoodies on. don't do it after the fact. You want to prevent problems before you have trouble.
Is it okay for me to hand out some dog treats?
Probably absolutely.
Whoa.
I know.
Dog fight. Okay. So, Whitney, you first.
Yeah. Well, the reason I would say absolutely is if you're taking into account the whole entire situation, if the dog is friendly, because then a dog is making a strong association with you or a person and treats.
Susan has some caution now.
Yeah. I totally agree with Whitney. Positive reinforcement, but ask first. And,
all right.
And if there are more than one dog present, don't get a fight going over limited resources.
Gotcha. All right, let's go back to the phones. Essex Junction, we've got Martha with a question or comment. Martha, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi there.
Hey.
My question or my comment, first of all, is to say that I am very allergic to dogs. So having dogs in stores and dogs in restaurants, well, primarily in stores that are not on leash, and trying to go for hikes at, for example, Shelburne Bay Park and Red Rocks Park, where there are clearly posted leash laws that more than half the people seem to ignore, is extremely frustrating for me. One time I was at Red Rocks and came around the bend, and there's a very large dog basically guarding the path ahead of me, looking right at me. So I stopped, and I'm also never grew up with dogs because I'm allergic to them, right? So I'm also not comfortable with dogs just because I didn't grow up with them. And the owners were just past him, and eventually they noticed me and called him back. And I said, thank you, I'm allergic to dogs. And their response was, well, that must be difficult with all the dogs around. And it's just very, very frustrating to not have people understand that it's not that I'm just being snooty, it's that it's a problem for me.
Excellent
and even
point.
If you were just being snooty, and I totally respect that you have allergies, you shouldn't have to encounter that, whether it's a medical problem or an emotional problem or I just don't like dogs. You shouldn't have to be fearful or fret that every time you take a walk in public, you might have to be kind of assaulted.
Dog owners pay heed. Let's talk to Bob. He's calling from Underhill. Hi, Bob. Thanks for joining Vermont Edition's conversation today about dog etiquette.
As an owner of a 80-pound German Shepherd, I think one of my biggest pet peeves is owners who have large dogs on extended leashes, you know, the retractable leashes. And I really feel that, you know, those are great for small dogs. But when you have a large dog, they're a mechanical device. They can my Shepherd can pull like nobody's business. And I'm fairly certain she would probably break one of those devices. But I see a lot where people just, they let their big dog out, you know, 20, 30 feet on these, and they think, well, I've got him under control on a big leash. I was like, you really don't.
Hey, Bob, great point. I mean, I grew up with a leash that was, you know, I don't know, twice the length of my arm. My dog was always right there. Now, these extended leashes, a dog can be two blocks away. And, you know, the owner doesn't know what's going on. So I'll start with you, Whitney. What do you think about these?
I think just like any other tool, there's a place for them.
Yeah.
There's a place where it does make sense. But there are a lot of places where they're being used, and it creates a lot of dangerous situations for other people. Using something like a 6-foot nylon leash and a head collar on an 80-pound German Shepherd in public would make a lot more sense. For a little dog, even something, a short leash makes a lot more sense in a crowded public area. Retractable leashes make sense in the countryside where there's not a lot of people around, or trees, or things for a dog to get twisted up in.
Susan, you deal with this?
Yes, we had an incident in our clinic. A woman with a fairly small dog had a retractable leash. She was checking out, so she was distracted. The dog went the full length of the leash. We have a short wall in the middle of our waiting room. The dog got around the end of the wall, went right in the face of another dog, and got bitten, and had his ear torn open. And the person with the dog on the leash was very upset. Obviously, her dog was injured. But she was blaming the other dog, and she never realized that she really caused that problem. Her dog was not under control. And those retractable leashes, like Whitney said, there's a place for them, but your dog shouldn't be 20 feet away, clotheslining other people, tripping other dogs, it's a problem.
So, Whitney, I'm coming to the realization that it's probably really important in those first 4 months before you go to the dog park that puppy has to be trained and has to learn socialization. So what do you do with – I have a six-week-old, mm-hmm. Beautiful bulldog. Mm-hmm. I want you to help. What do we do?
All right. Well, I'm going to back up a little bit to birth because one thing that a lot of people don't realize is how much socialization a puppy needs from the day that they're born. There's a wonderful trainer that you can learn a lot from named Ian Dunbar, who's done a lot of research on this very subject. And he has taught us that a dog, before it even goes home at about 6 to 8 weeks, should have encountered at least 100 different people. And the fact is that most dogs haven't. So if you just start there, you already have a puppy at 6 to 8 weeks old who is not socialized as much as they should be. So now you have a brand new puppy. It is in your home. It's part of your family. You need to get that puppy out and exposed to as much as you can. As Susan said, it is extremely important that these encounters are positive. They're not scary for the puppy. And yet you're checking off a lot of boxes when it comes to socialization's not just about other dogs, which a lot of people feel it is.
Yeah.
It's very much about a lot of different people, sights and sounds and surfaces. Our world in general, our human world, is very bizarre to dogs. Mm. So what ends up happening is that an under-socialized dog becomes fearful. Dogs who are having aggressive reactions are doing so because they're afraid.
All right. We still have a lot of callers who want some questions. Claudia from Hubbardton. Hey, Claudia, how are you?
Oh, good. Good. The longer I listen, the more interesting it gets.
I love it.
I've never called a radio station before. Anyway, I'm 76 years old. I have three dogs, and I was raised in Germany. I always had dogs. I can't remember not having dogs. And I found that in Germany, you could go to any restaurant and there may be five dogs under five different tables and you would never know it because they would be well-behaved, they would be staying there, and the waiter would first wait on the people and then bring the dog a little treat. You see, outside of stores, little parking areas where you can leave your dog, there are dog beds out there and toys and a place like rings in the wall where you can tie your leash and the dogs can either interact or they can just stay there and wait for their owners. To my great surprise, when I came to this country for the first time ever, I saw a dog crate, which I thought were cages. I said, oh, my God, they're keeping your dogs in cages here.
Well, Claudia, I'm just going to cut you off because we only have about a minute left, and I do want to hear from our two guests. I mean, what are we doing right and wrong here? I'll start with you, Whitney.
The caller's comment really echoes what I was saying about socialization, and I've heard this before, that in other countries, puppies start out really young out in public, just not in our country, and so they don't necessarily get the socialization. So it makes a lot of sense to me that that's her experience in Germany.
And how about you, Susan?
Well, and I think that she didn't say anything about seeing a lot of dog fights or bad behavior. So clearly, these animals were, for the most part, well-behaved.
Yeah. Wow. It's great to hear, and it can happen. All right. Dog owners, non-dog owners, we hope this was informative, gave you some perspective on what the other is going through. Cat owners, sorry. Dr. Susan McMillan, veterinarian and owner of the Old North End Veterinary Clinic and the Vet2Pet Mobile Veterinary Service in Burlington, and Whitney DeRemus, a certified dog trainer and owner of Superdog's Positive Pet Dog Training. You're also opening a dog training center called Vermont Dog Club in Essex Junction later this year. I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, everything's bigger in Canada. Just ahead, we're going to learn about the Great Trail. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. Long-distance hiking trails have an adventurous attraction to them. People set out on the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail with dreams of endurance, austerity, wilderness, and distance. But our neighbors to the north have been working on a slightly different kind of project, the Great Trail. It doesn't have the same claims of wilderness as the trails I just mentioned, but in distance covered, the Great Trail wins hands down. Valerie Pringle is co-chair of the Trans-Canada Trail Foundation and joins us to explain more. Valerie, welcome.
Thank you very much. I know we love to think that we, you know, might have something bigger than America.
It is massive. So describe the scope of the Great Trail.
Well, we talk in metric up here, 24,000 kilometers. So it stretches from coast to coast to coast. This is Atlantic to Pacific to Arctic oceans and links 15,000 communities across Canada and heads north. So we like to say, you know, first there was a railroad, then there was a highway, and now there is the Great Trail, the Trans-Canada Trail. And this includes the north, so it links the north as well. But as a nation of trailblazers and builders, which of course Americans are as well, it's how our country's opened up. It's a great way to celebrate that. And we're working on it. It's a pretty massive project.
And I will convert it for Americans. That's about 15,000 miles, which is a long, long trail.
We like to say the longest and grandest in the world. And we're, you know, as I say, we're working very hard at this moment for connection. And we're very careful about the use of that word. Connection in 2017. And 2017 is the 150th anniversary of Canada's Confederation. So there'll be great celebrations across our country next year. And this project began, in essence, after the Canada 125 celebrations in 1992. So there's a symmetry to kind of push and get connections there and link all these recreational trails across the country. But we're very careful to say, you know, we're not going to be completed. I think the Appalachian Trail took in excess of 60 years, and, you know, that's pretty impressive. So this one, I say my granddaughter will still be working on this trail to make it greener, to make it better, to make it more beautiful, and to add all the loops and spurs so that people can see this country.
It is a big project. How did this whole thing come to be?
Well, it was actually, you know, as I say, after the Canada 125 celebrations, and, you know, always in Canada, the government's involved with, okay, let's get the community celebrating and, you know, help fund some of these things. And I think the projects that most appealed to the two men who were sort of in charge of them and handing out some money, someone named Bill Pratt, who was a Calgary businessman, and a lovely man named Pierre Camus, who is still alive, who's a geographer from Quebec and a communications specialist, said, you know, we love these trail projects that are coming forward. Here's a simple idea. Why don't we simply link all the recreational trails across Canada and have the longest, grandest recreational trail in the world? And with that simple idea was born this great project, except I don't know if they really even could begin to envision how complex, how difficult, you know, what a whack-a-mole game it would be of, you know, linking trail and acquiring trail and essentially working mostly through volunteers, some government support for this provincially, municipally, federally, as often happens here, and then a huge amount of philanthropic support, too, which is what I've essentially been in charge of the last 5 years, having chaired it the 5 years before that, was the money side. So we've been looking to raise $75 million to get this connection for Canada 150.
The Great Trail is multi-use, so it's not just for backpacking, but also covers all kinds of terrain. So describe what kind of experiences people can have on the trail.
Well, it's every kind of experience, you know, as you can imagine in a country as huge as Canada. So it's urban trail through where I live in Toronto, the waterfront of Toronto. It's a lovely paved waterway with, you know, divided trail for cyclists and runners. A lot of people use it to commute to work. I also have a place in Niagara-on-the-Lake, so that's a trail there down the Niagara River, which is beautifully paved and gorgeous. And, you know, visitors, if, you know, people in Vermont wanted to go to the trail in Quebec, you know, the Lachine Canal through Montreal is magnificent through old Montreal. And then sort of more typical bike trails or whatever through, say, Eastern Townships, that sort of thing, hiking trails near Vermont in Charlevoix, near Quebec City, just east of Quebec City. Charlevoix is one of the most beautiful regions you will ever visit. And they're more classic hiking trails through the hills, but there are also a number of water trails. You know, the voyageur routes through northwestern Ontario, say, from around Thunder Bay to the Manitoba border. I mean, it was hard enough really building a highway and a railway there. So we went, look, these are some of the most beautiful paddling routes in the world. So they're water routes right now. Sometimes that's pragmatic because we just don't have the communities and the ability to build trail there. So sometimes you're in a kayak or canoe on the north shore of Lake Superior or the part of the St. John River or up the Mackenzie River, for example, if you're a real active person. And some of it is secondary road bicycling through, you know, Saskatchewan and beautiful rural country there. So, you know, it's probably, and some of it, as our chair likes to say, is so wild and remote that maybe, you know, you'd have to get there probably in a skidoo. And a skidoo is a legitimate form of transportation, the only motorized one in the winter on some of our trails in the rural areas.
Well, you touched on it. We are, of course, interested in the sections that come nearest to Vermont. Tell us a little bit more about the highlights of the Quebec section of the trail.
Oh, Quebec is magnificent. And I think because it's, you know, it's also about 99% done. I think there's like 50 kilometers of trail left to go in Quebec because I think it has much more a European sensibility of the significance of trail to communities and to health and that they are such a valued resource. People, you know, love to get out and walk. And so, you know, La Route Verte, the Petit Train du Nord, which goes up through the Laurentians, the La Route Verte, which goes all through Quebec. I think National Geographic Traveler rated that the number one biking route in the world. And portions of that certainly are part of the Great Trail. I mentioned in Montreal, the Lachine Canal bike path. You can rent bikes there. Go through Old Montreal. I mean, it really is quite spectacular. You know, Quebec City, if people haven't been there, you know, arguably with Vancouver, the most beautiful city in Canada for sure. Quebec City is awesome. And just east of there is a region called Charlevoix. It's got beautiful, beautiful hiking trails and great art. And Charlevoix and the Great Trail are, you know, definitely, that's sort of the upper part of the St. Lawrence River, and it's magnificent. Also, I guess a little closer to Ottawa, you know, that area mm-hmm. in the Gatineau through Wakefield, it's called. It's a great trail for hiking and cycling. There's, you know, sweet little country towns and stuff. Not that Vermonters need more beautiful towns and lovely hillside. I mean, you've got an abundance of those, but those would be lovely routes. Obviously, Eastern Townships, too, which abuts and which has, you know, reminiscences of your countryside, maybe obviously not as big mountains.
You mentioned that it's still not complete. So what is it going to take to get it completely connected?
Well, completely connected, we are saying we will achieve next year. Connected means we will have found routes, some of them secondary bike route. What you really love to see, obviously, is something like the Petit Train du Nord, which, as I mentioned, is in the Laurentians, where, you know, you can stop and stay, where you can rent bikes, where you can get something to eat, etc. So, you know, those are the kind of trails that you go, these are real gems, and these are tourist destinations as well, rather than just being lost in the wilderness.
And Valerie, why do you care about this project?
Well, it's funny. I'm a broadcaster. I was a broadcaster. I did the morning show in Canada for a number of years, and I was lucky enough to travel this country. You know, not many Canadians see this beautiful country. You know, we go to Florida or we go to Europe or something. So I have seen it. I love it. And from the first time when I was still doing the morning show here and I saw a little map, which was the idea, a little red line across the country, and I just went, that is awesome. It's awe-inspiring. It's iconic. It's audacious. You know, it's nation-building, all those things. It's about fitness and health and everything sort of wrapped up in this trail. So I got involved as a volunteer maybe 16 years ago, and I chaired the board for 5 years, and then when we decided we really need to be ambitious about fundraising, I had to learn about fundraising. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, my great passion. And so, you know, I'm hoping to leave this, as I say, to my children and grandchildren. And, I can't think of anything better to leave behind. I think it was Emerson who said, do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail. So I'm trying.
Valerie Pringle is co-chair of the Trans-Canada Trail Foundation. She's been explaining the grand ambition of the Great Trail, a multi-use trail across Canada. We have links to maps and more at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Valerie, thank you so much for your time.
Well, it's pretty hard to leave Vermont, but we'd love you to come.
And thanks to you for joining us today. Tomorrow, we'll focus on eating disorders. That's the topic of a new documentary by Northeast Kingdom filmmaker Bess O'Brien. She tells the stories of several Vermont families who have struggled with understanding and overcoming eating disorders, and she'll be our guest tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.